Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
It really does feel like it's NVIDIA's day in terms of what's driving the market action.
Yeah, well, especially since we're at the highest level that we've been since last August. If you take a look at the S&P 500, mm-hmm. I know Andrew Slimin was saying we're not going to break out of this range this summer, but I feel like we have broken out of this range already.
It does definitely feel like it. We were in such a tight range for a while, and a lot of it is, thank you very much, NVIDIA. So we wanted to talk a
Carol
lot
about... Carol takes credit for NVIDIA.
I don't take credit for it. I give NVIDIA credit for providing some momentum here. All right, so let's get to it. Because it did hit, is it still holding a trillion in terms of the market value?
It wasn't when I looked, okay. But it was at $995 billion. But what's a couple of billion among friends?
It got there today, and it's in a small, there's not a lot of names that have done that and held it. Let's get to it. Let's talk about the stock, the company, the AI exuberance, irrational or not. Bloomberg News equities reporter Ryan Vlastelica is with us on the phone from Chicago. And then with us is our Chip King, Ian King, actually. U.S. semiconductor and networking reporter at Bloomberg News on Zoom from San Francisco. Ian, forgive us. I know we keep reaching out to you, and I know it's like the same old story, but nonetheless, here we are once again focused on NVIDIA and its run-up or continued run-up. There is some news this weekend, or at least we watch the comings and goings of the co-founder of NVIDIA, his speech in Taiwan. What was significant, if anything, about that?
Yeah, I mean, to quote him as we did, I know it's too much. I mean, he spent 2 hours on stage trotting out, you name it, new machines, new data centers, new networking stuff, new this, that, and the other, lots of tie-ups, lots of things going on. And, you know, you take your pick as to which you think is the most important. I think the way that investors read it was like, this is a company that is not getting happy, fat and lazy anytime soon. They're absolutely relentless. You know, they are just coming up with every single angle that they possibly can to try to keep this momentum going. And that was the takeaway. And obviously we saw the stock react to that today.
You know what's funny? I saw just before we came on air a story about a bunch of AI leaders, ostensibly leaders here, including people from Google, from DeepMind, from Microsoft's OpenAI, or from OpenAI, in which Microsoft is an investor, who released a statement. Did you see this, Carol?
I did.
It's just one line. It says, mitigating the risk of extinction from AI should be a global priority alongside other societal scale risks such as pandemics and nuclear war. And, you know, recently they were asking anyone who's got an AI deep learning program or whatever you call it to put it on hold for 6 months, to stop training these chat bots. And it seems like they're all scared that like the leader's getting away. I imagine, Ryan Vlastelica, that NVIDIA wasn't one of the signers of this letter. They're happy for AI to run as fast as it can, aren't they?
Well, certainly the demand that they're seeing from AI and the processing chips that needs to run all these AI applications is something that is directly benefiting NVIDIA. And they have talked about how this is going to be an extremely long-term tailwind for them, something that's going to last at least 10 years or so as more and more of these data centers are built out to be able to accompany this kind of AI technology.
By the way, speaking of data centers, Ryan, do you look at, you know, for example, REITs. There are REITs that own a ton of data centers or big data center operators. Are all of these companies' stocks soaring along with NVIDIA?
Well, we're not seeing anything that's soaring quite like NVIDIA, but certainly there's so much enthusiasm about this space, and anything that has any kind of tangential connection to it has probably seen some pretty strong gains at some point this year. A lot of software companies, other chip makers, I mean, in addition to NVIDIA, we have AMD that's done quite well this year. Marvell Technology last week came out with another positive forecast and talking about the upside that it is seeing from AI. So certainly the gains are not completely located just in NVIDIA. They've been pretty broad-based.
Ian, when we saw the head of NVIDIA in a speech in Taiwan, I mean, as you said, been out there a lot. He's definitely very public, and everybody's kind of treating him, or they were in Taiwan, like a rock star, following kind of his every move. Is it just about selling the concept, justifying the enthusiasm in the company and the stock, or is it because they are in demand in so many ways because they have the ability to unlock AI's potential for so many companies? So some of it's justified, which we saw with that recent outlook that really just blew away estimates. So is some of it justified?
I mean, there are a couple of ways to look at it. I think if you were to ask Ryan that question as a stock market reporter, he would probably tell you on a valuation basis, probably not. No, we're at very high levels. But if you look at it from the perspective of what they are providing and what they are trying to do, which is not just to sell to Google, to sell to Amazon, AWS, but to be like, hey, this thing works, and it works much bigger if we can bring companies into the fold, companies that don't have all of these data centers themselves and don't have all of these genius computer scientists. So NVIDIA is addressing that as well. And if you believe that they'll be successful and that they will democratize AI, for want of a better expression, then arguably it does make sense. And to address Matt's point about this fear of AI, of Skynet becoming self-aware, NVIDIA's already got ahead of that and come up with this set of guidelines technology, which they're out there testing, and that they're going to provide that in theory means that you keep your AI chatbot focused on what it should be focused on, and you stop it going off the reservation and taking over the world.
It's so fascinating to think about AI becoming sentient, but I feel like we're so far away from that that we don't need to worry. Ryan, in terms of, I always look at insider selling, and I also always think of Paul Sweeney's comment that, when you're this hot, you got to raise capital, or you need to use your shares to buy something. I know a vice president of NVIDIA has raised, $7 million with a share sale, but maybe she was just buying a house or a boat or something that you need to live, right? Do you hear anyone talking about the possibility of a capital raise here?
No one has mentioned that to me specifically, but I suppose you can't rule it out. But honestly, I can't really say one way or the other.
And they're not terribly acquisitive either, right? Carol and I were asking people about this, and they said ever since the attempted takeover of ARM was shot down, you haven't really seen a lot of action in this part of the industry.
Historically, they haven't been that acquisitive, but what ARM sort of reinforced, not just for NVIDIA, but arguably for the whole of the sector, is look, you're big enough. Regulators do not want these companies creeping and becoming even more pervasive. And given, just how pervasive everybody now thinks NVIDIA is, it's arguably difficult for them to go out and sort of get hold of anything of significant size.
Ian, 25 seconds. What's the smart way to think about NVIDIA right now, in your view?
You've got a company that clearly understands that this is its moment and is throwing everything against the wall to try to make sure that it's not just a moment. That appears to be the way that people are looking at it. And so far, the company themselves are kind of justifying that approach.
Yeah, well, they definitely had their $1 trillion moment earlier today. Great stuff, as always. Folks, thank you. Ian King, U.S. Semiconductor Networking Reporter at Bloomberg News out there in San Francisco. Ryan Vastelica, Equities Reporter at Bloomberg News, joining us on the phone from Chicago. You are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser, Matt Miller. This is Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Matt, remember last week we talked about a story, it was, I think, among the most read on the Bloomberg. It was about how Wall Street is rethinking its gloomy outlook for stocks.
Yes.
You love this.
I love the story. And I remember someone was like, yeah, but we can't get Andrew Slimin to come on. And I was like, I just saw him in the office last week.
And ta-da! Our producer, Paul Brennan, got him. Andrew Slimin is Senior Portfolio Manager at Morgan Stanley Investment Management. He joins us on Zoom from Chicago because he did raise his S&P 500 target. So we're going to talk about that. Also with us is Yelena Shaletyeva, Senior U.S. Economist at BNP Paribas, former Bloomberg colleague, on the phone in New York City, because we want to talk about the economic backdrop that really supports maybe Andrew's outlook. Both of you, thank you. So, Andrew, let's talk about this. You now think what for the S&P 500? 4,600 at the end of the year, up from 4,200?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on. So, look, the lesson that we know about years when there's down earnings or not a very good earnings year like we're experiencing this year is that the market, number one, kind of anticipates that the year before, which is why you have a down year like we had last year. And then secondly, it starts to anticipate an earnings recovery year the following year, which is why you get a rally into the end of the down earnings year. And I think that as long as the economy holds in there, the market will price put a high multiple on next year's earnings estimate, at least this year. Now you can say, oh, the S&P will never earn $246 next year, but we won't know that this year. We won't know that till next year. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think you get a pretty good rally in the fourth quarter of this year. You pull forward some of those returns of a better earnings recovery next year to this year. That's what happened in 2020, late in 2020, and in 2021. And I think that's what's going to happen here. So as much as people are saying, oh, the Fed's going to raise rates, and there's a negative there. In my view, it would be if the Fed were to cut rates, that would be very bad news, because then that would imply to me that the next year earnings numbers are way too high.
Exactly.
And as long as that's not the case, then I'm comfortable that we're going to get that fourth quarter rally.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because I always, you know, I talk to all these bulls on Wall Street who think the Fed's going to cut rates, and I keep telling them, dude, if that happens this year, that means that something horrible has happened. Like, that would be the worst case scenario. Yelena, jump in here and tell us what you think about, you know, Andrew's premise, because when I saw his target, I thought about, you know, earnings this year, but he makes a very good point. The stock market is a discounting mechanism, so it really matters what happens to earnings next year or even the year after.
Well, let me just start with, saying that we certainly don't expect any rate cuts this year. So, and as you said,
you don't, but the market's priced in too.
Yeah, totally. So I think we are still expecting a slowdown in economic growth this year. And that is happening. It's just not happening to the extent that would be really drastic enough for the market. So I think we are still heading to a slowdown. And the further we go into the end of this year, the more we will see. So think about things like spending, consumer spending. It's still holding up, but things are slowing down, and we'll see that in the, you know, auto sales report later this week, I think, and we will see that in payrolls numbers as well, because we're expecting another solid reading, but it's going to be lower than the previous one. And, you know, this kind of a theme we will continue to see this year, I believe.
Hey, Andrew, like, are there caveats to it, though? I mean, as we, you know, kind of get our way through D.C. and hopefully this gets done and we can kind of cross that off our list. But we still have, I think, some regional bank worries out there, right, that could pop their, rear their ugly head maybe once again. I think we're still watching the war overseas in Ukraine. There are things that seem to sometimes just jump out at us. Are there caveats to your forecast?
Yeah, I mean, look, so
beyond the Fed cutting rates.
Sure. I think my premise is we have a high levels of fear in the market, and that's reflected in high levels of cash. And one of the comments I hear all the time from advisors is, you know, why should I buy equities when I get 5% in treasuries? Well, you know, I was an advisor in the 90s, and clients were coming to see us in the 90s and saying, I'm not greedy, I just want 15-20% returns a year, right? Because we were in a greed phase, right? Now, 5% looks nice because you lost money last year. So the question is, when do we go from fear to greed, or fear to FOMO? And I think right now, with 5% risk-free and the lots of uncertainty in the markets, people are comfortable with 5%. But as we get through the summer, I think that advisors are going to get nervous that they're carrying high levels of cash, and maybe clients will start to be critical that they're missing out on the rally. So to your question, I think it's too premature to think the market's going to break out of this range that we're in this summer. I totally agree with your point that, you know, look, we have not resolved this regional bank issue. I've learned that always there's always some geopolitical issues that pop up in the summer. But I think as we get past Labor Day and we get into the fall and people start looking, oh, I got like 3 months to go, maybe, you know, that's when I think the anxiety about being underinvested will start to weigh on people.
I mean, Yelena, you can't really talk about the animal spirits of the whole thing, but how does financial stability look to you? And you were saying you don't expect any cuts this year. If we get through this year without a recession, you know, do we assume soft landing? Is that what's happening next year?
I think, well, no cuts, but no hikes either. So I think, you know, the current economic data will allow the Fed to make a pause and see what happens next. I think there are a lot of different things happening in the economy that will show a significant slowdown come summer. And I think that will allow the Fed to just stay on hold to keep fighting inflation going forward. But I think we will end up in a recession. It's just that we're in the phase where we only see a first signs of a slowdown. And then, you know, it can happen very rapidly once we get to a certain threshold of economic growth, at which we will see quite significant declines in employment numbers. And I think that is coming towards the end of the year. There are a lot of signs that are telling us
right.
that things are rolling over.
So, Andrew, how would you suggest somebody position based on your outlook? How would you position, certainly when it comes to the equity trade?
Well, first of all, if we get, you know, do we get a debt deal done, I think that you'll see the market broaden out because the cyclical areas really got hit, industrials on, you know, the worries of debt default. So some of the areas that like infrastructure spending and so forth, those stocks sold off. So near term, I expect that you'll get a broadening out beyond this, just this very narrow breath. But I wouldn't be surprised this, as we mentioned, that there's further issues this summer, and I wouldn't bet on that's more than a trade. But I think going into the fall, again, I'm just not, maybe I'm a portfolio manager, I'm looking at from bottoms up, I just don't sense this weakness. And so therefore, I do think that the breadth will widen out. And that's the big misnomer that I hear. People all talk about narrow breadth will lead to a sell-off. And that certainly was the case in the year 2000. But if you actually analyze the data, more times than not, narrow breadth leads to broader breadth at some point. Can't just assume it's the end of
you can't get any narrower.
Other places for the money to go, certainly. And if you're looking for a deal, hey, thank you both. Andrew Sliman, Senior Portfolio Manager at Morgan Stanley Investment Management, along with Yelena Shalitjeva, Senior U.S. Economist at BNP.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We did get some U.S. economic data today, Matt. I'm not sure if you saw it, but consumer confidence in the U.S. falling to a six-month low, views about the current state of the labor market, and the outlook for business conditions slipping ahead of a deal to raise the debt ceiling. So that was kind of the setup there ahead of that. Along those lines, Primerica is out with its financial security monitor of middle-income Americans. So we thought maybe we'd get some details.
We were just talking about middle-income Americans, right?
We were talking.
How we always get the bill.
We do. Although I'm curious what defines middle America. Are middle American. So let's see what Glenn Williams has to say. He's the CEO of Primerica on Zoom from Duluth, Georgia. Glenn, nice to have you here with Matt and myself. Tell us a little bit about the survey, who you talked to, what you wanted to know, and what you asked them, and what exactly defines a middle American?
Is a middle income investor different in Columbus than it is in Manhattan?
Well, we see a lot of similarities across the board. It's great to be with you again. But we survey the middle-income market every quarter, and our intent is to really understand what they're grappling with, what the challenges are in their financial lives, so that we can provide better guidance and advice for them. We define the middle market by household incomes between $30,000 and $100,000 a year. I'm sure there's a wide variety, but that's what we find is the sweet spot, and we find that they do have a lot of common ground in the financial challenges that they're addressing, as well as some common ground in the attitudes they have about their finances as a group, their individual finances, and what the future looks like.
I mean, it's already a good start if they're thinking about something like financial planning and retiring to begin with, right? How many of the people that you surveyed, what's the percentage of Americans with household incomes between $30,000 and $100,000 that are saving for retirement actively?
Well, we're always surprised at how well informed and how optimistic this group is, because they are dealing with some pretty tough financial challenges. So we see an improvement in their attitude slightly since the pandemic overall. You know, we find out that about 52% rate their financial condition today as good or excellent. And so I think when you look at the challenges they're dealing with, that's a pretty optimistic view of the world. And I think that optimism is good because it gives them hope to be able to stretch and try to improve their condition and, you know, make up for the areas where maybe there are gaps in their finances. And they are very receptive to advice and guidance, which is what we want to see, how we can help them as we sit with them and help them plan for the future.
I think it's interesting that fears of a possible recession fell from the previous survey, dropping 4 percentage points to 21%. We spend a lot of time talking about recession, no recession. Talk to us a little bit about that and also their prospects and how they see the job market at this point, because I feel like we talk about maybe having a recession, though, with a tight labor market.
Right. I think that many middle-income families are probably confused about the definition of recession. That's a theory. The reality of what they're dealing with is the higher cost of living. And even as we have seen inflation slow, what we're seeing is not that while the inflation rate is lower, prices are still higher. And so it's not getting better. It's just getting worse more slowly for middle-income families as the cost of living compounds year over year. And so while I think middle-income families might vary on their own definitions of recession, I think they're very clear that the cost of living is much higher. And that's what they're struggling with, is how to prioritize, how to budget, how to plan for the future in light of the increased pressure they're experiencing today versus a couple of years ago when we first started doing the survey.
So, the increased cost of living is surely their biggest challenge, but a further increase isn't worrying them, right? These the people that you surveyed aren't concerned about inflation, or at least it's like less than a third of them that are.
Well, I think they're less concerned than they were. And to me, some of that comes with familiarity. The longer we're in an inflationary dynamic, they find out it's not the end of the world. It's difficult, but they hear it quarter after quarter. And then oftentimes they realize, as we go out with our survey question, that there are other issues that they're grappling with as well that might be newer on their radar, and they tend to move a little higher to the surface. When we talk about health overall, and I think probably built into that was healthcare costs, while the question was specifically about their health, I do believe that some answer that question thinking about how much it costs to maintain good health and to protect good health. And so I do think some of it is just the longer issues have been in our lives, we adapt to them. We find out it's not the end of the world. They move down the priority scale and something else takes its place. And so there could have been some of that in the trending around that question where health moved in front of inflation.
I, the interesting thing, Glenn, you know, we were just showing the winners and losers in terms of industry groups on the stocks on the S&P 500 today. And I thought it was interesting that consumer discretionary stocks were the biggest winners and staples were the biggest losers. Now, in your survey, almost three quarters say their income is falling behind the cost of living. So that would mean to me they need to cut back. And indeed, a majority, 80%, said they are cutting back on non-essential purchases.
You're exactly right. And that's what we find when we sit down with these families, is it's always a process of helping them prioritize. Most homes that we come into are probably not saving enough for their retirements and their future. They're probably not as well protected with life insurance as they need and other services that we provide. And so we're not going to manufacture any new money in their budget. We've got to sit down with them and help them reprioritize and reorder. And I think that's some of what the survey results showed in the other surveys, non-Primerica surveys, is people are making very tough decisions about what do I do about the staples. There are other luxuries in life that probably have sustained themselves better than you would think. Subscriptions, use of our technology, we pay a lot for that, and middle-income families do, and they hang on to that. But ultimately, there's going to be a point at which you reach your limit, and you've got to decide, I'm going to let go of one thing, and I'm going to maybe add something else.
Like Warren Buffett was saying that he finds people would rather have their iPhone than a second car, which I thought was interesting.
Well, I think, like, how do you live or exist in this world today without
But there
your
are
phone?
Other makers of phones than Apple.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's also well in.
So far we've seen people holding on to, you know, many of the brand names and what we would have thought just a decade or two ago were luxury items. There aren't anymore.
Yeah. I have a question for you. When you said the range of middle America was $30,000 to $100,000, if you're a $30,000 family, is prioritizing more about just basic needs like housing, food, and so on?
Absolutely, that's where it starts. And what we find, unfortunately,
I guess what I'm wondering is what's left over.
Yeah, there's not very much left over, but often you can find in almost any budget, there's often some waste, and that might be just a little bit of a negative term. It's often there are low priority items that could be replaced with higher priority items, even at the low end of that spectrum. And we do believe that families, when they're capable, do need to protect their incomes, because the loss of a breadwinner is even more devastating in that situation than it might be at the upper end of our scale. And so we do try to sit down with families and help them explore ways to try to meet those needs. And sometimes we find out we just can't help at this moment, and we make an appointment to come back when maybe, you know, times are better, or a job has been found that wasn't found before, or a better job has been found. So there's always a discussion to have. Usually there's action that can be taken, but we can always follow up to help those families. If they've got as little as $25 a month,
yeah,
they can be helped in some way.
Hey, real quickly, Glenn, credit card debt. What are you seeing on that front? Got about 45 seconds.
We're seeing increasing use of credit cards across the board. I think we're at a record high credit card debt as a nation today. And we are seeing that in the middle market. And we're seeing credit card usage more often for the staples, for the necessities of life, where in past credit cards might be used for big purchases and that kind of thing. We're seeing people use credit cards to bridge the gap from month to month. It's not a positive sign.
All right. Going to leave it on that note. A great view into, as you said, a lot of what makes up certainly this country. Glenn Williams, thank you so much. Chief Executive Officer at Primerica on Zoom from Duluth, Georgia.
Hopefully they're paying off the bills, right? Because if you look at the survey, middle Americans continue to rely on credit cards for everyday purchases, including gas, retail, and groceries.
That's what he was just talking about.
Yeah. But the thing is, a lot of those purchases may be on credit cards, not because they aren't able to buy them with cash from their savings account, but because it's so much easier. I mean, have you ever gone to a gas station in the past 5 or 10 years and paid cash?
No,
everything is you click your watch or you tap your phone, or you know, even the card can be tapped. So, and as long as you're paying the bill right away, it's not a big problem.
It's the default, right? If we start to see that rise. All right, you are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
I did want to get to a story that is online at BusinessWeek.com. And it has to do with a new elder care benefit, actually. The name is PAPA. It's a little bit unusual. It's being offered by some well-known health plans, and it's embroiled in assault allegations. As we said, this story online, and you can find it at Bloomberg.com/businessweek, also on the Bloomberg Terminal. So let's get to the story written by Bloomberg News Technology and Venture Capital reporter Priya Anand, with us from our bureau in San Francisco. Priya, nice to have you here. Talk to us a little bit about PAPA, this service, and how it works.
The company is venture-backed. It's a handful of years old. It's been valued by investors, including SoftBank and Tiger Global, at $1.4 billion. Their model is essentially bring the gig economy to elder care. So they have a network of independent contractors who can sign up within minutes, go through a background check process, and get onboarded. And then those folks are sent to the homes of elderly clients who are members of health plans that the company contracts with. The company does a lot of business with Medicare Advantage plans. Some of the country's biggest insurers are customers and clients of PAPA, including Cigna, Humana, Aetna, Anthem, which is now called Elevance, and other major insurers across the country. And working with Medicare Advantage, they're essentially, this app is essentially taxpayer subsidized.
And, well, the thing is, even before I read your story, which is moving, to say the least.
Absolutely.
Elder care and child care is the last place I want the gig economy to be. Is everybody for this? It's such a bad idea.
Well, what we found in our investigation, where I reviewed more than 1,000 incident records of complaints that have been filed with the company by members, by its own workforce, the independent contractors who are the pals that they send, that's the term they've given their workers. You send a pal to the home of an elderly member. The company's whole thing is they remove the nursing element from home aid. And so, you know, they send independent contractors with very little training, a short video that they watch for training, into homes. And the way they were able to sell this to insurers is there's a huge shortage of caregivers in this country. But at the same time, in reviewing the more than 1,000 records of complaints that have been filed, it's clear that their contractors are sent into situations that they're unprepared for, situations that might not be safe for the member or the worker. There's been harassment on both sides of members and workers. And it does lead to some questions around, is the gig economy the right model for a company of this sort, right? And part of the reason why this has been something that insurance companies have signed on board for is that there is this severe shortage of caregivers in the U.S. The Surgeon General has talked about this. You know, people have written extensively about just the lack of caregiver services in America. And in this case, the population that this company is serving, Medicare Advantage plans, oftentimes folks are very vulnerable in that population, and cost is also an issue. So when this company, PAPA, partners with a health insurance plan, oftentimes the insurance plan will make it available as a service to its members for, you know, X amount of hours a week that they can use this thing for free. And if they don't have any other form of help, they don't have family members who can be caregivers for them and family members who can help them get to the store, to the bank, to do laundry, things like that. The idea is that they would then turn to these contractors through this app.
Right, exactly.
Or family on demand, they call it.
We want to bring in the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine, Joel Weber. He's here in our studio as well. I do feel like this is the kind of story you guys do so well. It's like very specific and really gets into the details. And it sounds like there's still a lot to figure out about kind of either how to make it work better or where it all went wrong.
Yeah, all Priya and her excellent reporting on this one. You know, to Matt, to your point there of like, who thinks this is a good idea? Well, you know, the company does. And, you know,
the company also picked the name PAPA, which is a terrible idea.
It solved
a need and branding
that the CEO and founder actually had some personal experience with. Mm-hmm. And so scaling that is totally where this came from. Of course, we are in this massive shortage of workers everywhere. And who needs to spend time with people? Well, like, elderly people need to spend time with people. In theory, this sounds great. It's just sort of one of those realities where the gig economy meets up with something that hasn't totally been kind of proofed in the real world. And the scariest part to me is just how weird and crazy the real world is, right, Priya? And like, we haven't even talked about how troubling some of these allegations are. What were some of the ones that blew you away in your reporting?
I mean, this was the kind of story where once I started digging into the complaint records, it was the kind of story where really I couldn't stop thinking about what happened to some of these people. Some of the records were so disturbing. I mean, assaults of elderly members of these health plans by the people who are sent to their homes to be essentially help around the house. That was incredibly disturbing. Allegations on the reverse side, where women have been sent to the homes of elderly men who then have assaulted them. And a range of incidents such as show how unprepared these independent contractors are when they go to these homes. They
right.
just don't get enough training. They end up walking into homes that are covered in feces, sometimes animal, sometimes human, or homes that are right. laden with cockroaches. And I spoke with people in the healthcare space who said, you know, when a worker is trained to handle these Priya. Issues, they can expect that.
Priya, I'm so sorry. We do have to jump in, but I do highly recommend that everybody check it out online and on the Bloomberg. Priya Anand and Joel Weber here in our interactive broker studio. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.